From Brighton on the English South Coast, these are the voices of the Royal Pavilion and Museums with Dr. Sophie Frost.
Hello, I'm Sophie, and I've spent the past 9 months wandering the corridors of the Royal Pavilion and Museums in Brighton and Hove, otherwise known as RPM, uncovering the stories of the museum people who keep Brighton's historic buildings and collections relevant, vibrant, and accessible for the world we're living in.
Well, my name is Robert Hill Snook, and I'm head gardener of the Royal Pavilion Gardens. Been here over 20 years. And my role is very multifaceted, but basically I'm here to manage and maintain and conserve these Regency gardens, which are of historical importance, and have a wonderful beauty and usage that I think is worth highlighting, because I think sometimes the gardens are slightly misunderstood because of the style of them. And of course the fact that they're very much in the centre of the city and never really closed at all, 24 hours. So, you know, we do have our problems and we do have extra work, and it's not always easy to keep them looking as clean and pristine as possible. Mm. The period of when the pavilion was built, of course, which was the end of the 1700s or early 1800s, the gardens were created in the first sort of 20 years of the 1800s. And at the time, various, I think, designers put in designs for the garden, and some obviously turned down. But it's believed that John Nash, who designed the pavilion, went on to design the garden. I won't go into too much detail, but basically it was very much influenced by nature and inspired by the countryside. And that's why we call them the picturesque or nature assisted. So it's that natural look, but also obviously you're cultivating, you are managing that, but you're still trying to keep that natural look. So the garden is inspired by the countryside, and that's why it has that slightly wild natural look, not over manicured, not over managed. But, of course, I think the misleading thing there is that, you know, you have to do a lot of quite serious maintenance, because if you don't, then you lose that effect. So that's one side of it. That is the nature, and we have obviously a lot of wild native plants. The other big influence at the time was a growing interest in horticulture, obviously a growing interest in travelling. People started to bring new ideas, new styles back from overseas, and of course this was imitated, and this was plants as well. This period, early period, was the beginning of plant hunting. So these are the two main strands, this garden, the nature, and then what they referred to then as the exotic, because all these new things like peonies and poppies and interesting, some of the Abelia chinensis and some of the shrubs that people had never seen before were starting to arrive from the plant hunters' endeavours, and would have probably been shipped to Kew and then, you know, filtered down. But of course Prince Region would have had the pick of the best and all the latest things, right. whether it was a new rose bred in France or whether it was a new this or a new that. Mm. So it's this juxtaposition of nature and that exotic, but in a very loose way. And the idea is that you use the planting, it's very informal, and no straight lines, it's very informal, and you look through the planting to the pavilion and the various buildings, and this is where you get these wonderful vistas and views through, using the plants as the sort of framework, and that enhances the pavilion and the dome and the two gatehouses or whatever, because you're not actually seeing them all at once, you're getting glimpses. And that is more tantalizing, that you know, you sometimes you look through and you just see up at the end of the pavilion, and then the, you know, sort of the half moon, and you just get that lovely view through. It's only that view because you're the planting blocks up the other part of it.
No one's ever put it quite like that, so it's really nice to hear it. I think and you mentioned it had been a bit misunderstood sometimes within the city. What did you mean exactly? Do you think some people don't realise it's...
We mustn't forget that the gardens have evolved. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're going back, you know, 200 years, and there was a period when this present garden, this style, didn't exist, because the original Regency garden disappeared, perhaps because it didn't get the right sort of maintenance. And of course time moves on, and then during the Victorian period and right up to the 60s and 70s, seaside places, towns like Brighton, were famous for their bedding plants and their bedding schemes and the very colourful, ornate, beautifully manicured, well-maintained, colourful. I mean, you'll still see it in Eastbourne and places like that, although it's very, very high, intense maintenance.
Yeah.
And so when this garden was newly restored, it wasn't quite what people expected. And there are people who don't understand, and because this is not overtly colourful.
No.
It's about shades of green. It's not about neatness. It's about naturalness. You know, the grass is a bit longer because that's part of the style. And we have to think of what horticulture was like in those days. And of course things have moved on with technology and machinery and science, and we can achieve more in a way, but in the early days, and I like to think this is an example of modern gardening. This is the first time that of this type of garden had ever really been done, because it was, the gardens were very much tucked away. They were either in a wall, tucked away from the house, apart. Or they were formal gardens or landscape gardens like Capability Brown. This is the first time that a garden, this style of garden, where the building, whatever it was, and the garden were as one. They complemented each other. And so it had never really been done before. And of course, I suppose when you think about it, there was a lot of experimentation. New plants were arriving. And in some, you know, here, for instance, we've, you know, honeysuckle, which you always think of as a climber, was used as a ground cover plant, and they used it to spread it along the ground rather than go. They didn't have any previous experience with some of these new plants coming.
That's interesting. And when was it restored?
It was restored back in the late 80s, early 90s.
So behind me are all the maps from that...
The plans,
from the restoration.
Yes. The garden is split up into various beds. And as you walk the serpentine paths around the garden, of course, you come across these beds. Some of these beds might line the paths. And as you walk around the building, the pavilion, the flower beds contain more flowers. As you retreat from the building, as if to go towards New Road, or the beds become more foliage and more natural looking, because the idea is that you are retreating into the countryside. That is the image, that you're not in a city, you're not in a town. That's why we're very keen to keep the perimeter of the gardens green and of a certain height, and so we're blocking out modernity, really. We'll keep it like a Regency oasis. The beds more, you know, that are more inclined to be around the building, around the pavilion, will more than likely be a mixture of a small tree, could be deciduous, could be a conifer, shrubs. Evergreens are very, very important because they give you the backcloth. They're permanently there all the time. Then there'll be some deciduous shrubs too, which will change and give interest throughout the year. So we might have a spring flowering shrub, we might then have an autumn leaf, something that does things with berries, you know, so that. And then the next sort of planting would be herbaceous, and then you've got annuals, and then you've got bulbs, but very much in their own place. Nothing must dominate. Nothing must... We don't have drifts of things. We have what they call like little jewels of colour in front of the evergreens to give that sort of effect. And a great deal of the maintenance is trying to keep those different groups in order. So, and that's not always easy. And, you know, for instance, some of the evergreens, and some of them are now, have got too big. And we've got to think about cutting them down, coppicing them, and maybe replacing. Because and this is probably what happened when the original Regency Garden no longer was here, was that if you don't do that, then it just becomes a big shrubbery because all the underplanting is lost. The other thing is, and I talk about having spring and summer, this style of gardening, we mustn't forget that this is probably the only fully restored Regency Garden in the country.
Right.
It was planted even in those days to give what they call succession interest, succession planting, where you have something of interest month by month.
Hmm.
Whether it's, you know, and so sometimes you walk the gardens, one bit of the garden or one part of the bed or even one bed has been good, say, April, May. It goes off, and then you look to another part of the garden, which will then come into its own, perhaps June, July. So it's very much about that, and as I say, it's the first time that there was succession planting.
Mm.
We're ready.
Okay.
So let's go.
Yes, you don't mind my stuff being there for a minute, do you?
No, that's fine. No, that's all right.
Okay.
I'll do the double lock.
Okay. So this is the North Gate.
This is the North Gate.
Why is it called the North Gate?
Because it's the North.
And that's the South Gate.
But it's actually also known as William the Fourth. It should be William the Fourth, really, and that's built for William the Fourth, who became king after George the Fourth. Only the only reigned for a very short period. But by then, of course, Brighton was much busier. More people, more activity, and that was built. So the only way in was through the gates. And on either side, you would have had soldiers billeted in the where we've just come from.
Wow.
And they would have been on duty in that room, and then they would have slept upstairs where the volunteers meet. All these hundred years later, here we are. I'm using it. It's the garden room. We do like to keep a lot of the herbaceous sort of seed heads and things going as long as possible, because they also give a bit of interest in the garden and contrast against the foliage and stuff. And also they're very, you know, for the birds and the wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
But it comes a time when it all starts to look a bit tatty. So this is the gradual process of as it gets tatty, we cut it down. And then serious pruning of some of the shrubs. We can't do that until we've cut the other stuff down. It's a process. It's a process of garden maintenance. And that is
yeah.
Autumn. And the garden is, it's a bit like, you know, the National Trust. They're always saying they're putting their houses to sleep, and they sort of tidy and put shutters and da-da-da-da. And we're doing the same with the garden. It's nice. It's sort of like putting it to rest, really, for the winter and the autumn.
What would be your favourite time of year in the garden?
Well, I quite like this time of the year. I like it because it's less busy. I quite like the melancholic sort of atmosphere of the autumn and the colours and the shade and the smells and it's like saying goodbye to one year, and we're sort of getting the garden prepared for a new year, and that entails, you know, every plant needs nurturing, whether it's feeding or pruning or too big, and this is the time when you do all that with the thought of there's always another opportunity for next year.
Mm.
You know, the conditions might be different.
Or, right.
So that's the positivity about gardening.
Yeah.
And yes, I think we all have a dull time at this time of the year and things are... But you've got to look forward. And if you have,
Okay, well, I'm climbing over into the bed too.
What would be doing?
Well, I was hoping to capture some garden sounds.
Mm.
Where do you think the best place to loiter is to capture garden sounds?
Would it be possible to take us?
I mean, you don't want mead in it. You want garden sounds, as
well,
in birds.
Well, I mean, you can do interjections of if you'd like. That might be quite nice.
But I'm just saying, do you want sounds like chip, chip, chop, of you know, cut, cut, cut.
I think actually just the bustle of it.
Me muttering.
you muttering.
Why haven't you grown this year? Tut,
tut, tut. You talking to the plants would be brilliant.
I mean, you want to get away from the public. No, if you want to sort of get the sound, you might get the sounds great. I'll give you permission to go up that path.
Okay.
There, somebody's chucked some seed on there, and of course this is where.
Oh, okay. So I'm seeing cigarette butts and drinks cans.
Yeah, well,
that's life.
That's every day, sort of. And you can hear the busker. But all I can say, so is I think you just got to keep wandering around. So I heard something there, a little birdie.
How many times do you think you walk around this garden a day?
Oh, I don't know. I do a lot of mileage, I know. Going from A to B and the B to, you know, all the various places.
I was thinking how fit you must be.
Well, I'm quite fit, really, for my age. I think I'm fit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, well, yeah. No, I mean, it's part of the job, yeah, isn't it,
yeah,
I guess?
Yeah. I'm not happy if I have to have a day indoors.
No.
I can get quite grumpy. Fling open the back door and I've got to get out in the garden just to have a look. But I think a day for me cooped up in a house all day is.
That's a very fat squirrel. I mean, it's fascinating just following you, Robert, because I feel like you see things.
The more you supply, the more you offer things, the more. Yes, I think you've made yourself known. And of course, the other thing is that we do have the predators in here. Sometimes we get magpies, sometimes we get jays. I have seen one jay, there may be a pair of jays. And of course, in the spring, they will be producing. And they, I'm afraid, prey on other birds, smaller birds. Well, here's one of my volunteers now.
Ah.
Hello.
I wasn't due to come
today. No, that's all right. Nobody came today.
Nobody. I know Veronica didn't.
But I think various
my
people.
My friend Val. So
hello, Val.
I think
I've met you before.
So I don't. I've just.
So would it be possible to talk about the community of volunteers and other gardeners
yes.
you work with?
Well, I have now. I haven't always had, but in the last 4 or 5 years, I've had a part-time assistant.
Mm-hmm.
Called Wayne, and he does quite a bit now of the domestic side of the to relieve me of it, and there is a lot of it, and that, you know, that entails litter picking, and that has to be done every day, and bin emptying, and this relieves me of having to do it, where really my effort should be more towards the horticulture, and this, you know, especially as there's only one full-time gardener.
Mm-hmm.
But also, he now does quite a bit of the grass cutting because he likes doing that, and it's a good thing for him to do. So that's very helpful. But from the word go, there have been volunteers, and the original group, which was set up for a Friday morning, is still going strong. It's a very, very successful, encouraging thing to do. And it's been going for this Friday group's been going for 25 years, based here, and they usually do an hour and a half Friday morning, and then they finish about 11:30 and have coffee here, and we have what I refer to as a plant ident. So they have something like a dozen little snippets of whatever's in season or whatever's flowering. And I pick little bits, and then they have to identify them. They have to learn the Latin name.
Right.
And then we have a very brief, that's what this is all about, plant ident. So we line them up here. What is it? So we have to give it its proper Latin name, but we also obviously go with the common name as well, because that helps. What type of plant is it? what does it do? What significance does it have in these gardens and how we maintain it? So there are five key questions there that cover quite a bit of information. Being a volunteer, you know, there can't really be any pressure. But at the same time, there has to be an element of learning. I think if you come here to volunteer, you give your time, and they're obviously helping us out. It's nice to give something back. But then again, it's up to the individual how much they want to invest in. So I can't affect that. But that is a very good starter.
Yes.
And it, you know, you imagine having 12 plants every week, or maybe not 12, 10, over the months. If that can build up, and I say, if you do it properly, you can then build up a huge information on...
Does that mean that around Brighton and Hove somewhere, there's just lots and lots of wannabe Regency gardens springing up in people's back gardens?
Well, I think I people do say, oh, well, if I see it growing in the Pavilion Gardens, it'll grow in my garden. Now, that's probably because of the salt... Being close to the sea, and a lot of plants have to be salt resistant. I mean, I don't know, well, you probably remember about a month ago, 3 weeks ago, we had those dreadful, dreadful gales that were salt laden, and the garden is affected by it. You know, now the trees have all gone brown prematurely because they've been burnt by the salt, quite a lot of the plants, and that can happen, and there's nothing we can do about it. And also because we're on chalk, so that's never... So people do say, oh, well, I always often come through and I say, and if that's growing, I'll try it. And majority of people like the natural look. They like that look in the garden, and they do try to imitate it.
Yeah.
We have plant and seed giveaway days and things which are very popular.
Oh, I bet.
I say giveaway, we ask for donation, but that's been going for years and years. The volunteers at this present time are collecting the seeds. This last couple of Fridays they've been harvesting.
Right.
And the public love it.
Again, sort of a big... That's quite an outreach endeavour, really.
It is.
You were mentioning it earlier about the public and their... use of the garden. Could you go into that a little bit more?
My phone.
Do you want to go and get it?
I'd be fine, let it go. It's so complex. It's a cross-section of people. I mean, it could be just a thoroughfare. It can be a place for people to hang out. It can be a place for students, young people, not necessarily young people, not necessarily to get up to no good, but they can get away with maybe having drink and alcohol and smoking and da-da-da-da. And because the garden is as it is, there are lots of places you can hide. You can, you know, because it's quite a lot of greenery and shrubbery. So it you know, it works against us in one way that people can come and do that. And then, of course, we have all the local people who live nearby, kind of elderly people who live, who've probably had to give up their gardens because they're now living in flats. They may have a dog, and they use this as their daily walkthrough, and this is their garden, which I think is a lovely... Another group are the people who work in this area, and again may have high powered desk jobs glued to a computer. And, you know, people said to me, oh, you know, coming through here in the morning sets me up for the day.
Oh, that's nice.
You know, just to hear the birds singing and just to see what's new flowering. And that, and because it has that natural, and you've got this depth of interest, because if you let your mind really sort of, if you don't sort of get too worked up about maybe the grass is a bit too long or something hasn't been deadheaded, or da-da-da-da. You can lose yourself in the beauty of it. And I think with this garden, there have always been those people who just don't get it and those who do. You know, a garden is a place of solace, is a place. I think this is where, you know, people come, searching for something.
Mm.
They're searching for answers, perhaps, and especially if there's an element of rest about it. You know, this is why we've got all the green, the shades of green. Maybe some people do find some answers here. I hope they do.
And quite rare in a bustling town centre to have something like this.
Mm. See this woman here? Now this is a typical, this is something we get a lot.
Oh, she's feeding all the pigeons.
And she's covered herself with pigeons. And she's mass feeding the pigeons, which in some ways we would rather not have because it can be very problematical and it creates other problems with women. But this is her life.
Mm.
And we have quite a few number of people now who come in daily. Look, she's looking to throw it down. And that, this is why we have rat problems. That it caters for people who maybe have mental health problems or who are just lonely or who have been let down by other humans. And they have far more respect and love for animals and birds than they do for their fellow human beings. And it's very difficult to intervene and say, sorry, but we'd rather you didn't do that, or could you? Because this is their existence.
Mm.
And so that's what I mean when I, you know, it's all the whole spectrum of people's feelings and emotions, and see them all here.
It's funny because it's not really that big a plot of land.
It's not.
That it plays out.
Oh, it attracts all from all different, for whatever reason, whether it's the shopper walking through, whether it's the person from overseas coming to visit the pavilion, whether it's the lonely old person who lives on their own, who just comes in here because they want to love the gardens and the nature and see people and maybe want to, they might have a little chat with somebody.
Could you just talk us through like the initiatives that are happening with mental health and well-being and the garden at the moment?
Whether or not it's because it's the times we live in, they're obviously saying now how important nature and gardening and plants and wildlife are to mental health. You know, as far as I'm concerned, I've sort of known that for years, that there's a great therapy in gardening and studying nature and beauty and art. But sometimes you have to rekindle it and because it's such a technological age now, that maybe the younger generations have forgotten how to observe and how to, you know, it's on your doorstep. You don't have to go on your phone. You know, you can actually see it there and then as you're walking through. You might see a thrush. You might hear a thrush. You might, but of course, you know, you've got to perhaps remind people. I do believe that a garden, this garden, any garden, is a great wealth of material to help people perhaps get over something or even understand themselves. We do have a certain amount of people helping in the gardens who've got problems. Obviously, we have to limit it a little bit because at the end of the day we're trying to recreate an historic garden. You know, we care, of course we care. But at the end of the day, I have to come up with the goods. So, but we do have people, and you could even go as far as to say that when one retires, and we've all, you know, this is something that a lot of people do when they retire, they go and volunteer. I think the very nature of it is very good for even at that stage in your life, because you know you've just given up work.
Mm.
You've given up some sort of routine. You're not seeing the colleagues that you've seen before, you know, over the years. Your whole life changes. You join something like this, and it's like a new purpose, isn't it? Because you're actually doing one thing. You're out in the fresh air.
Mm-hmm.
You might be learning a new skill. You might not be learning a new skill. you're working with nature, which I think is marvellous. You're meeting people, and you are, you know, you have to sort of stick to a routine.
Mm.
And then there's a social side to it.
When you were talking about the spiritual side of the garden, for you, in the way you talk about it, it does feel like a calling. I can sense that in the way you discuss it, actually. The
garden, first of all, I would say it's a privilege.
Hmm.
Because I don't want to go into it too, but I'm a believer that God sends us into various aspects of life for reasons. And we're all here to do our bit, mm-hmm. in one way or to t'other, to make a difference.
Mm.
I've even with problems and challenges, a garden is something that can change people's lives and can just change people's attitude, just even if it's for a few minutes. So if you're actually part of that, if we're all working as a team to create something that somebody's going to see, and maybe they will leave thinking differently, or they may think, or something might put a smile on people's faces like the sunflowers, you know, that's great, isn't it? To think that you've actually been part of that.
Yeah, it's a type of service, definitely.
It's a huge privilege, really. Mm. You know, I'm very lucky to have been given that opportunity.
We talk about climate change, don't we?
Yeah, okay. Look at
the rose there. This is
the pink
1st
one.
Of November. And that's very unusual at one time to see roses still flowering. You've got various ones around the garden of different colours. And this is one of our later flowering herbaceous plants that gives a bit of colour. But of course you see now the flowers are finishing, and now the seeds are forming.
These
little black seeds in here,
which
will be collected by my volunteers. I think they've already... Hello, how are you? Yes, we're doing a little bit of... recording.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh good.
Yes, I was just talking about... Sophie was asking me about what is sort of flowering at the moment. And I was just saying, and it's probably got a lot to do with climate change.
Yes, indeed.
To have a rose flowering on November the 1st.
Yes,
it's not normal,
is
it?
Not. No, definitely not.
So how are you today?
Good.
Are you visiting?
My grandchildren all at the ice cream.
It's half term, isn't it?
Oh,
half term.
That's nice.
Yeah. So we go down. They've got a family ticket for the whole season now.
Yeah. Good.
They go almost
every
day.
There's quite a lot on at the moment, isn't there? What, one thing and another.
Yes.
Well, the sun's coming out too.
Hooray!
Even better, it might be a nice sunny afternoon.
Yes. Good luck, then.
Well, nice to see you.
And you. Garden's looking good, actually.
Not
isn't
too
it?
Bad, really.
No,
it's
no.
The shape that's
yes,
still
coming on.
And there's still a bit of colour, and there's a little bit of interest still around. Yes. I think, you know, we can all be in denial, and I think it's a slightly selfish attitude, isn't it, when you say, oh, well, isn't this lovely to have this sort of weather now? Long term, it's a worry. It's a worry, and in our small little way here, one notices it.
Yeah.
And one notices... and of course, I realise we're in the south here, but it's very rare now that plants get knocked back by frost. And the other thing is that the grass keeps growing. You know, at one time, you could stop mowing grass because it got very cold, and we might have a frost that would knock the grass back. And you would probably say, oh, right, that's the end of mowing now until March. Not now. You might get the mowers out in just before Christmas, and because it's all starting to look a little bit overgrown.
Mm.
Grass. It's things like that.
Mm. Oh, that's beautiful.
I mean, this is fuchsia.
But they
fuchsia magellanica alba. It's quite unusual to have this still flowering on November the 1st.
Do you think it's
because we've had so much rain?
It's partly rain, but it's warmer.
Right. This guy is great, actually, isn't it?
This is a haven for nature, this type of garden. Mm. We don't use chemicals in any capacity at all. It's totally organic. So we do encourage bird life and insects, and we've even got foxes living in the garden now. It's always been a challenge, this garden. You can't, you know, you try to put it in some sort of category, label it, da-da-da-da, you know. Should it be this? Should it be that? Is it a park? Is it a garden? Is it an historic garden? Is it a... You know, it's very difficult sometimes when it's in such a busy and... You know. For me... It epitomises what Brighton's about. Brighton, you know, even going back to George IV, I mean, you know, he was that the Prince Regent. This whole reason for having this was about fun-loving entertainment, slightly hedonistic, enjoying life, enjoying the good things of life, whether it was architecture, art, food, or music, or not always behaving, you know, well, perhaps, overeating, you know. Mm. And I suppose that really has embedded in Brighton and has continued. So the gardens, in a way, are very much tied to that. And it's very difficult to unravel it.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we don't.
And
need to.
I just say, it is what it is. It might not be quite what it should be, but it is what it is, and there's something very unique about it. There's something very, and I think that's the beauty of it, is that there's probably nowhere else quite like it, because of all the ingredients that go into it. It's unique.
Mm. Do you feel hopeful about it and what the legacy of it and what it is and what it can be? Is there anything that needs drastic attention, or is it?
Well, I do worry about it because it does need special maintenance, special knowledge, really, to keep the historic side of it. It does need quite a lot of money spent on it.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain areas of the garden, quite a lot of the garden now, that needs replanting and re-looking at again, and the hard features, and you know, I think everybody's aware, and I suppose because of modern times, and it needs protecting, but then at the same time, and I suppose this is very easy, you know, contradiction. One, you know, we mustn't change and ruin its uniqueness, which I was trying to. And it's very difficult to specify and pinpoint that. So I would like to think that the gardens will continue, that maybe there will be improvements made, that the essence of the gardens will continue, and then the historic side of it, and because I think that's important. But that they will retain that uniqueness.
Thanks, Robert. I think that's... And we've got a lot of rich, really rich stuff there, so thank you.
I've been as honest. Yeah.
No, thank you. Thanks very much. I'm going to press stop now. Mm. It was an absolute pleasure to spend time with Robert and his garden, absorbing his serene and philosophical perspective. I was struck by the many roles that the Royal Pavilion Garden plays in Brighton, as a place of solace amidst the urban sprawl of nature, retreat and rest, community, play and pleasure, and of revelry, albeit sometimes unwanted. Robert is a true museum treasure, with a vast wealth of horticultural knowledge and a fascination with Regency Gardens, mixed with a sort of poetic wisdom on the humanity that crosses his path on a daily basis. In other words, Robert helps us to understand the scope and scale of the people that make up Royal Pavilion and Museums in Brighton and Hove, and that they don't just work indoors. My thanks again to Robert Hill Snook for participating in this episode, as well as to the garden for unbegrudgingly letting me traipse around it and pass comment on the size of its squirrels.
Next time on Voices of the Royal Pavilion and Museums, Dr. Helen Mears, Keeper of World Art at RPM, will be in conversation with Sarah Lee, consultant and advisor to the museum, as well as co-founder of Brighton and Hove Black History, on some of the black and minority ethnic cultural heritage projects to have taken place in recent years. See you there. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, hit like and subscribe, and please leave us a very nice 5-star review. Find out more about the Royal Pavilion Museums at brightonmuseums.org.uk and more about this project at oneby1.uk. On Twitter, I'm Soph_Frosty and RPM is Brighton Museums. I really hope you can join me next time. Till soon, goodbye.
The voices of the Royal Pavilion and Museums are supported by the oneby1 Research Project, the School of Museum Studies at the University of Leicester, The Keep, Arts Council England, and produced by Lo-Fi Arts. Lo-Fi.